Good morning and welcome. The Free Congregation of Sauk County is a Unitarian Universalist Fellowship and a welcoming congregation. This means that our invitation is to all, and that all are welcome here, regardless of race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, gender expression, or political persuasion. And I'm Robin Proud. I have the honor to be one of your rotating speakers. All right. Yes, and I'll just read the quote that's at the top of the second page there by Lucy Stone. In education, in marriage, in religion, in everything, disappointment is the lot of women. It shall be the business of my life to deepen that disappointment in every woman's heart until she bows down to it no longer. Well, everyone recognizes Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton as the leaders of American women's suffrage movement, and that's partly because they literally wrote the book. But there's another woman who was at least as famous in her time and broke ground in multiple areas, but is less known today, and that's Lucy Stone. At the time, she was so famous or infamous that supporters of women's rights were called Lucy Stoners. She extended her quest for equality into areas of women's dress, marriage, and property rights, and equal pay. She also insisted on fighting for abolition and civil rights at the same time as women's rights. As usual, it was a new book that encouraged me to take on this topic. Leaving Coy's Hill by Catherine Sherbrooke came out in 2021. It's a fictional story of Lucy Stone's life, but I followed that up by reading the more scholarly Lucy Stone, An Unapologetic Life by Sally McMillan. And I found that although Sherbrooke, of course, added conversations and emotions to the historical record, overall, the novel is quite close to historical events. So if you would like to learn about her in that way, I do recommend it. Now, for many of the people I've talked about, very few of us had even heard of the person. In this case, many of us recognize the name, but don't really know anything about her life. I certainly didn't. When Lucy Stone was born to a Massachusetts farm family in 1818, her mother Hannah supposedly said, "Oh dear, I'm sorry it's a girl. A woman's life is so hard." Hannah knew what she was talking about. Lucy was the eighth of nine children to grow up on a 400-acre farm. Although we have few details from Lucy's childhood, she had vivid memories of how hard her mother worked. The family valued basic education for all the children. They also were strong abolitionists. Lucy was very impressed by the Grimke sisters and a woman named Abby Kelly. Those were all touring anti-slavery speakers. But this was a time when women speaking in public was generally frowned upon. In fact, the local Congregational church, which Lucy's family attended, issued a so-called pastoral letter denouncing these speakers with a famous quote from St. Paul, "Let the women keep silent in the churches, for it is not permitted unto them to speak." Now, Lucy had already found herself questioning many of the things she heard in church. Now she said, "If I ever had anything to say in public, I should say it, and all the more because of the pastoral letter." So we see this right along. Anytime someone told her she couldn't do something, she was determined. There's a story that Lucy was shocked to discover that when her older sister married, the new husband could sell off a favorite horse, since all the property was now his. Officially, the husband took over all the legal and financial rights of the woman. That's one of the reasons that Lucy decided at a young age that she would never get married. Although the family sent two of her brothers to college, higher education for women was practically unheard of. When Oberlin College in Ohio began educating women as well as black students, Lucy had to save up her meager earnings teaching in one-room schools. It took her till the age of 25 to save up enough. And while in college, she had to take on jobs teaching, doing housework, and mending clothes of other students. She also taught at a town school for free blacks. She had to work in these with her time for attending classes and studying. And there was no possibility of taking the time or money to return home on any vacations. During her sophomore year, Lucy was surprised to receive a letter from her father with an offer of money. Her parents had not been supportive generally of the idea of her going away to school. But her father wrote about how hard he had worked in a tannery as a young man and how disturbed he was to learn now that Lucy was getting up at 2 a.m. to study. He offered to pay for her tuition, room, and board. However, Lucy preferred to borrow from her sisters and brother and only took money from her father her senior year. Oberlin was a very small institution. There were 34 men and 7 women. Lucy's closest friend was Antoinette Brown, called Nettie. While Nettie was traveling to Oberlin for the first time, an upperclassman on the same coach warned her about Lucy, who held wild and radical ideas on religion and other subjects. Well, with that introduction, Nettie was eager to meet Lucy. She was surprised to find Lucy a small and young-looking figure. They became great friends, and when Lucy shared her goal to be a public speaker on abolition, Nettie explained that she wanted to become a minister, something that also highly discouraged. Once she left home, Lucy rarely attended church. At Oberlin, there were required classes and lectures on religion and church services. Lucy's daughter later wrote, "The long discussions on the Trinity made her a Unitarian." In a letter to her brother, she wrote, "I have not changed my views of church, ministry, Sabbath, or matrimony in the least." As graduation approached, all the students competed in writing an essay, and Lucy was the winner. The professor announcing this then told her, "You have the opportunity to select the male classmate of your choosing to read it for you at graduation." Lucy petitioned to read it herself, but was told the college would simply not allow the spectacle of a woman speaking in public. So Lucy refused to allow the essay to be read at all. By chance, her story came to the attention of two people who happened to be attending the graduation and asked to meet her, William Lloyd Garrison and Frederick Douglass. These were heroes in the abolitionist home of Lucy's family. Garrison asked Lucy to become a traveling lecturer for his anti-slavery society. You might remember from some of the talks I gave on people like Francis Watkins and Caroline Dahl, how rudimentary the travel arrangements were for women speakers. Trains were noisy, dirty, and smelly. Many of the towns had no train service, requiring journeys in various kinds of carriages and wagons in all weather. Local hosts sometimes provided rooms that were of questionable safety or cleanliness. Some of the hosts were downright hostile, as were some of the audiences. And Lucy's own family disapproved of her public speaking career. From the beginning, Lucy was determined to speak on both abolition and women's rights, although this meant she was paid less by the Anti-Slavery Society because she couldn't give them all her time. Lucy did not attend the famous Seneca Falls meeting, but soon after, Elizabeth Cady Stanton specifically recommended hiring Lucy to speak on behalf of the movement. And the biographer Sally McMillan says, "Within 3 or 4 years, Lucy became one of the most recognized names in America. By the early 1850s, Lucy was earning hundreds of dollars a year, a considerable income, particularly for a woman." And some of the other women I've spoken about never really earned enough to pay for their way, so she was so successful and famous. In spite of her small stature, Lucy apparently had the ability to command a room and induce people to listen. She included stories of individuals, such as enslaved women, in her talks to increase the audience engagement. She became a standard organizer and speaker at the many conventions held on women's rights and abolition. By the 5th National Women's Rights Convention in 1854, Lucy had become the acknowledged leader of the movement. She and Susan B. Anthony became close friends. As single women, they had more in common than with Stanton, who was married and had multiple children. Both Susan B. Anthony and Lucy Stone experimented with a new style of dress, giving up corsets and wearing bloomers under loose frocks. However, the audiences and the press fixated so much on the clothing instead of the message that both women decided to return to traditional fashions. Only one man dared to challenge Lucy's refusal of marriage. He ended up doing it on all her terms. Henry Blackwell already had a non-traditional view of women's roles. His sisters were Elizabeth and Emily Blackwell, the first two female doctors in the United States, and I spoke about them a couple of years ago. Henry admired Lucy and agreed with all her positions. He became a friend and assistant in her work, writing to her regularly and helping organize her tours. He insisted he wanted a marriage of equal partners and mutual support. He wanted her to keep her own property, income, and name. But it wasn't easy for Lucy to overcome her distaste for the legal ramifications of marriage. She also wasn't totally convinced of Henry's commitment until he took dramatic action. Abolitionists heard that a slaveholding couple with a young enslaved woman would be passing through Salem, Ohio by train. Hundreds of abolitionists assembled, but Henry was the first to board. He asked the girl if she wished to be free. When she said yes, he picked her up and passed her off the train. This open defiance of the fugitive slave law caused Southerners to accuse Henry of robbery and call for his arrest. But Lucy was impressed by his action. Now, ironically, his sisters, Elizabeth and Emily, the doctors, were never supporters of suffrage, and they didn't quite approve of Lucy. Some of this was social snobbery, since she was from a working-class farm family. When they got married, Henry and Lucy issued an official protest stating their refusal to follow any laws that diminished the wife's rights, and she did keep her own name. Lucy didn't adjust her busy schedule after marriage, which was another thing that was important to her. In the fall of 1856, she went as far west as Racine, Milwaukee, Madison, and Janesville. Wisconsin was also one site of Henry's land investments. This was a business that he developed that ended off paying off well. In fact, in 1856, the couple briefly settled in Viroqua, and the biographer says a town comprised at that time of some 30 shanties located in an area where Henry held 6,000 acres of land. So some of us have undoubtedly been past that land. Traveling across 250 miles of frontier to get there was a challenge. Living there proved even more of one. They found themselves removed from any cultural stimulation and far from people with whom they shared anything in common. Now, I would guess there were probably a lot of Norwegian immigrants in the area. To her father, Lucy described the beauty of the land and the abundant wildlife, yet also wrote that she was miserable because settlers were so indifferent to abolition and to women's rights. They were probably just trying to survive. After a few weeks, the couple gave serious thought to moving east, and Henry admitted they had grown weary of this slipshod, scrambling, dissipated Western life. And within a few months, they moved back to Massachusetts, and the next spring purchased a farmhouse in Orange, New Jersey. As a married woman, Lucy was eager to become a mother. It took her almost a year to become pregnant, and she continued to work for her causes as long as she could. When she wasn't traveling to speak, she helped organize the upcoming Women's Rights Convention. Her daughter, Alice Stone Blackwell, was born in 1857, and this did keep Lucy at home. However, only 2 months after the birth, she made national headlines by refusing to pay her local taxes. She claimed it was taxation without representation. The town constable seized enough of her household goods to pay the tax and put them up for auction. But Lucy had already arranged with a sympathetic neighbor that he would buy them at the auction and she would then pay him back. The New York Times criticized the whole affair as a publicity stunt. When Susan B. Anthony wrote to Lucy complaining about the hardships of life on the circuit, Lucy replied, "You are tired with 4 months' work. If you had measles and whooping cough added to all you have done, it would not be half as hard as the taking care of a child day and night is." Lucy had no nearby relatives, and Henry was often traveling for his real estate business. And I don't think that they had the funds to hire nannies and a lot of other servants. Henry was also away the following year when Lucy miscarried a boy at 7 months pregnant. This was in 1858. Soon, national events would overshadow personal tragedies. Women's rights organizations put their campaigns on hold during the Civil War. Many individuals worked on the relief and health efforts for the Union. The war did bring one benefit to Lucy and her family. Wartime inflation led to the couple making a large profit from bonds and real estate, so that by the early 1870s, they had a net worth equivalent to almost $1 million in today's money. The big question after the war was how to advance the rights of the newly emancipated Southerners and the rights of women. Susan B. Anthony and others assumed that the amendment giving the vote to blacks would say all citizens, which would mean men and women. Lucy and Henry traveled to Washington, D.C. to try to convince Charles Sumner to remove the word male that was currently in the amendment, all male citizens. When the 14th Amendment only mentioned men, suffragists felt betrayed. Lucy and Henry went back on the speaking circuit. Lucy was worried she might have lost her oratorical skills, but she happily wrote to Susan B. Anthony, "I speak as well as ever, thank God." Still, she encountered resistance. One man said that if his wife wanted to vote, he would have pounded her to death. Others spread rumors that Lucy and Henry advocated free love. There was also a split in the women's movement. Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and Reverend Olympia Brown, who you might know, allied themselves with a flashy figure named George Train. Although he supported women's suffrage, he was an unstable and showy figure and an open racist. Lucy and Henry were horrified by this alliance. Around this time, Anthony herself started to talk about how unfair it was that ignorant immigrants and uneducated Black men should have the vote, while cultured white women didn't. Anthony and her supporters refused to support the 15th Amendment, while Lucy accepted that the life or death plight of Black men in the South demanded immediate action. When Anthony and her cohorts started the National Women's Suffrage Association based in New York, Lucy Stone created the American Women's Suffrage Association based in Boston. All this travel and stress was bound to affect Lucy and Henry's marriage. On an extended trip to Florida, where he also had real estate dealings, Henry spent a lot of time with a Mrs. P. Nobody knows how far that went. Throughout their marriage, Lucy and Henry spent long stretches of time apart and were committed to their political and business ventures. In 1870, Lucy tried to improve what we would call work-life balance by switching from traveling to writing. She moved to Boston and started a newspaper. She wrote to Nettie that the speaking circuit was not consistent with any home life or any proper care of my family. I feel it more and more and shall certainly not continue this mode of work. I long for a snug home. She hoped that her new paper, the Woman's Journal, would give her a way to contribute to the movement and live in a family. Reception of this paper was mixed. There were many compliments, but the New York Tribune predicted the paper's early demise. Lucy retorted, "The only way to stop the Women's Journal is to give women suffrage." Although Lucy did travel less, she not only wrote large parts of the journal, but she took on the fundraising, advertising, sales, and subscription management. She continued to publish this newspaper for the rest of her life, and her daughter, Alice, joined her when she grew up after graduating from Boston University. The paper made no money, and Lucy took no salary. Rather, she and Henry supplied funds from their real estate profits. Lucy continued to be very active in the American Women's Suffrage Association that she had started, and her biographer states, "While she only served as president in 1872, Lucy led its executive committee and played a pivotal role in organizing annual conventions, rallying members, raising money, and working on state suffrage campaigns," because there were initiatives in various individual states to get women the vote. She attended every convention until her health made travel too difficult, and these conventions occurred as far away as Minneapolis, Omaha, and Topeka. At the 1870 convention, the split between Lucy Stone and Susan B. Anthony widened. Anthony stood up in the public session to question why the organization didn't work more for changes in divorce laws and women's property rights. She said Lucy Stone herself had, quote, refused to submit to the legal form of marriage. Lucy's supporters felt this was a personal attack and that Lucy's marriage was as legal as any. Anthony apologized, but the harm was done. Anthony may have been jealous of the success of Lucy's journal since her own attempt at a woman's paper had failed. She made statements about how weak the journal was. So we see this today, right? Talking about how some other paper is failing or TV channel that you don't agree with. And Anthony went along with the perennial claims that Lucy's faction endorsed free love. And this hostility endured a long time. At one event when Susan B. Anthony was present, as Lucy was collecting donations in a hat, she raised the hat when passing Susan, saying, "I don't want any of your money, Miss Anthony." Susan dropped in a half dollar and Lucy snapped, "At least you can be sure you give it to a good cause." That's quite sad for this to occur between two people who were close friends and allies early in life and still wanted the same basic goals. This rift contributed to Lucy's work being largely omitted from Anthony and Stanton's important history of women's suffrage. In 1876, when the centennial celebration of the United States was held in Philadelphia, Lucy refused at first to take part. She said, "It was shameful that on our nation's 100th anniversary, women are politically and legally still in a bad place." Eventually, she agreed to submit a small exhibit 2 feet square about tax protests by women. But when visitors told Lucy they couldn't find her exhibit, she discovered the box had been placed on a high shelf where no one could see it. A Mrs. Gillespie, who was in charge of the women's pavilion, told Lucy that this protest was unsuitable to this time and place. So overall, here the biographer says a few things about Lucy. In reading about Lucy's life and her relentless fight for justice, it's hard to fathom how she sustained her spirit and dedication to a movement that lasted so long and stirred so much opposition. Yet her belief in the cause of women's suffrage never flagged. It was to her the bedrock of her existence, forming and informed by her character. It was little less than a form of religion, providing her with a way of reconciling herself to the world and making it better, that gave her the strength to pursue the endless campaign for women's suffrage, despite crushing results, and the many men and women who were indifferent or opposed to the cause. It was her strength and courage that often inspired others. Lucy once said, "It is because I have this quiet faith in the certain triumph of the right that I am entirely undisturbed by anything which venom and ill nature can do." And this sounds similar to things that Martin Luther King said. Macmillan goes on, "As has become clear, Lucy was a far more complicated individual than she appeared to the public and to the hundreds of suffragists who admired her. Lucy could not have been easy to live with, so determined, moralistic, and occasionally self-righteous. Lucy drove herself relentlessly in pursuing her dream for this country, but often left little time for moments alone and with her family." In 1874, at the age of 55, Lucy suffered from rheumatism, which made both walking and writing difficult. When her sister-in-law, Emily, the doctor, diagnosed both bronchitis and pneumonia, Lucy was finally forced to take some time off. It wasn't until 1887, when Lucy was 68 years old, that Lucy and Susan B. Anthony met to discuss uniting the two women's groups. This was not a harmonious process. There were disagreements over who should lead and even over the movement's history. Anthony insisted that the Seneca Falls Convention was the beginning, while Lucy Stone recalled personally earlier meetings and protests. It took 2 years for this merger to be completed. In 1893, after a speaking appearance at the Chicago Exposition, Lucy became very ill. She continued to write letters and received guests in support of the great cause, practically up until her death in October 1893. Her daughter Alice reported that Lucy's last words to her were, "Make the world better." In typical iconoclastic fashion, Lucy stipulated that her body was to be cremated, a rare choice at the time, in order to avoid wasting space on Earth. Of course, it was to be another 27 years before the 19th Amendment passed, witnessed by daughter Alice Stone Blackwell, a constant figure in the movement. So we have some time for questions or discussion. And one thing I did want to say is that for our young people, it probably seems very odd that girls and women did not have these opportunities. And just recently, there has been a lot of talk about how in some areas, in academics, for instance, women are and girls are doing much better than boys and young men. Someone recently suggested that all boys should be redshirted, that is, wait a whole year later to start school because their maturity takes longer, or that other radical changes should be made. And certainly in college now, many colleges, there are more women graduating. So nothing is supposed to indicate that we should favor one or the other, but it's interesting to see how some things have changed. On the other hand, representation at the top levels of business and government, including presidency in this country, still is not up to where it could be. I'm not expert on this, but it is an infamous quote that it's in, is it the Gospel of Paul? "Let the women keep silent in the churches." Yeah, there are fundamentalist Christian groups today that still follow this, that a woman should not be a preacher. Now, whether this is an example, some of these things they're translations of translations, or we don't necessarily know the context. And of course, that is not the word. Those are not the words of Jesus. These are the words of another person, or perhaps put in there by later authorities. But that's still used. Yes, they did get married. Yeah, they did get married, and at the wedding, they made a statement saying that we are getting married, but we refuse to follow any law that says that she has to give up any of her rights, or that I take any of her rights, and so on. And they kept separate finances, and she did keep her name, which was an unheard of thing. Although there was a problem. There was some place that she went to when she was able to, there was some kind of local election where she was able to vote, and then they said she couldn't vote under her name. And so she wrote Lucy Stone, wife of Henry Blackwell, so that could occur, something like that. But yes, he really worked. He made quite an effort to win her over. He was convinced that they belonged together. Yeah, the UUA has a huge initiative called Widening the Circle, which is apparently sometimes about making very drastic changes. On the other hand, I mean, there is the history. It's sort of like, well, should we get rid of all these statues of slave owners, for instance, or should we have that there and also have information about it? Yeah, is Jefferson still up there? I was going to say.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that the founders may have idolized these figures, but I think it's the second point there in their list out there that says men and women are equal here, which was radical for 1850 or whatever it was. Sorry, go ahead. Yeah, you could say the same is true in the race areas too, that although these laws are on the books, the various voter suppression laws and imprisonment and various things are not carrying out the spirit. And, you know, people who come in now are going to be, maybe we are hoping that younger people will be coming in and they may have a different expectation of what they want to see. Yeah, and just a minute, Matilda Anika is someone I talked about once who was a German and Wisconsin person, so she certainly fits in. Thank you, everyone.